Thank you. May it please the court and good morning. This is an appeal from a Rule 12b6 dismissal, a ruling subject to de novo review by this court. At the heart of the district court's ruling was its conclusion that plaintiffs cannot recover under the Defend Trade Secrets Act or RICO because the defendants first obtained and then extinguished plaintiffs' trade secrets by publishing them prior to May 2016. Which is when the DTSA was enacted and theft of trade secrets became a RICO predicate act. The district court erred because the defendants are stopped from using their own publication of stolen and misappropriated trade secrets as a defense to their subsequent use, possession, and disclosure of that information after May of 2016.
Just a minute, when you say stopped by their use, didn't your client consent to that publication?
Your Honor, our client entered into three agreements. I'm going by the complaint, which we have to take as true. In none of those agreements did he permit Google or any other defendant to publish those trade secrets without compensation to him. He has never received compensation for those trade secrets, which Google internally values at being worth up to $120 billion per year. He's never been paid for them.
But the, certainly
that was never.
I thought the terms of the assignment agreement said that he was making his assignments for consideration, and he was acknowledging that he'd received that. I'm not quoting it exactly, but paraphrasing, the documents indicate that he was receiving consideration for the assignment. Why should we disregard that?
Two points, Your Honor. There was a temporary license granted for the purpose of, in essence, evaluation of the potential of the trade secret. That was not in some unlimited permission for use. And second, it should be disregarded because the plaintiff has alleged that he was, in essence, deceived into entering these agreements in the first place, because the defendants did not intend to compensate him for his trade secrets.
Okay, so the first agreement you noted was a non-disclosure act that allowed the parties to share information as part of their negotiations. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and then there was a second agreement in which your client assigned rights in this information, and then Google filed for patents. And it appeared from the record that he knew they were going to file for the patents. Is that correct?
He did know that was ultimately one of the objectives, yes, Your Honor. However, again, he did not consent to any such filing without compensation.
Okay, so you're saying he was deceived. Is there anything? I guess the issue is we have a contract at issue in contract terms. Is there anything ambiguous about those contracts that would take us into parole evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, ultimately, there are contracts to be decided, but those contracts were not the basis of the district court's ruling. The district court ruled on standing, and it ruled on the elements of RICO. It didn't rule on the basis of contract.
Right, but I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Shishio.
The ruling, though,
was that he didn't have any rights as of May 2016. Those rights had been extinguished by these contracts. And your argument is, as I understand it, is that you agree that the statutes at issue are not, the DTSA is not retroactive, but that there were continuing violations beyond that date. And for that to happen, he would have to have rights on May 2016, which the district court found that he didn't. And that comes from these contracts.
We allege that he did, and the district court's ruling was not a contract ruling. Respectfully, that was not the basis of the ruling. Our defense, you're correct, we do not contend that DTSA is retroactive. The Theft of Trade Secrets Act had been law since 1996, but it did not become a RICO predicate until the same time that the DTSA was enacted. And so we have argued that estoppel prevents the defendants from relying on the wrongful publication of the trade secrets. That's not retroactivity. That estoppel is a well-established principle. We have cited cases going back into the 80s, actually into the 60s, and some of those cases rely on decisions back into the 30s, saying that a misappropriator or one who has stolen trade secrets cannot, in effect, the Seventh Circuit used was baptize themselves. That was a D.C. circuit, baptize themselves by publishing that which they have wrongfully obtained. And so our part, we are not arguing that somehow the DTSA or theft of trade secrets became effective prior to 2016. We are arguing in response to their defense that they are stopped from asserting that defense based on their wrongful conduct. We just simply respectfully disagree with the district court. That's not retroactivity. Retroactivity would be if we were asserting claims that arose prior to 2016. The basis for our recovery is what happened after 2016. The retroactivity analysis by the district court causes a great number of problems. These are very broad statutes, and it would be perverse to have a situation where, in essence, a violation of one subsection of the DTSA would somehow cleanse or absolve another pre-existing violation. That doesn't make any sense. And beyond that, we have the clear circumstance under Section 1832, which is the Trade Secrets Act, pursuant to which nothing in that statute suggests that a violation of one subsection cancels out a violation of the other. The court was very focused, district court was very focused on the misappropriation. That's the initial violation. But these statutes, DTSA and theft of trade secrets, are much broader than merely the misappropriation. That's the initial taking. But if you look at 1832, for example, it is very carefully designed to extend beyond that, as is the DTSA. And they separately prohibit the use or possession of those trade secrets. Section 1832 is actually broader than the DTSA because possession is broader than use or possession. Use or dissemination.
I'm sorry to keep focusing on this one point, but for that to apply, your client had to have ownership. He had to have rights for the somebody else's use of his intellectual property to be wrongful and covered by the statute. And I understood the district court's ruling to be that his rights were extinguished by the assignment. And I know you're saying it's not a contract issue, it's a standing issue, but it's a bit of both, because if you're saying that, this contract he signed doesn't really extinguish his rights, then I think we're going to be looking at California law and interpreting that contract to see if there's ambiguity, if we can look at parole evidence, you know, what the terms of this contract mean, and were his rights in fact extinguished. Would you agree that if his rights were extinguished by the assignment, that he doesn't have claims for wrongful use or misappropriation?
Your Honor, the DTSA, when you look at the definitions under the statute of misappropriation and of
counsel, I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. Can you start with a yes or a no and then give me an explanation?
I'm sorry. Your Honor, if in fact all of his claims, all of his rights were extinguished, then they would be gone and he would not have that claim. I agree. Our point is that they were not. We don't agree with that. I think your question in effect presents the circumstance where it would be as if he never had it, but he did. And the written agreements acknowledge that. And his point quite clearly in the complaint is that he was deceived as to what Google's intentions were. And we allege very specific circumstances of deception, including Google going so far as to lie to Mr. Adia and tell him the entire Project Genie had been shut down, when in fact it was being transferred to Flux and it was being continued and augmented. So if they had those rights, there was no need to lie to him. And there was no need to attempt to extinguish. And when you look at improper means under Section 1839 of the DTSA, it includes, as well as breach of a duty to maintain secrecy, any misrepresentation that's involved. It's basically obtaining the information by any wrongful means. And the complaint is quite clearly alleges that that was what occurred.
So you are right in about 4 minutes. Did you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, I would. Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have a clock appearing on my screen. But yes, I would reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so now we have Mr. Graves and Mr. Kent who are going to split time. Can you see the clock? It should be on screen.
Yes, Your Honor, we can. Yes.
Okay, so keep an eye on that clock. And Mr. Graves, are you going first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Charles Graves for the Google defendants. Robert Kent is also here for the Flux defendants. We've agreed to split our time. It's 5 minutes for Mr. Kent.
Okay, hold on just a second. I'm sorry, Mr. Graves. The clock isn't running, so I need to make sure we get it running. Wayne, can you make sure the clock starts running for Mr. Graves' time?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Your Honors, this court has two sensible options for how to proceed. First, whatever happens in the California Court of Appeal on the summary judgment ruling on ownership, the court can simply affirm the district court's thorough opinion. Or, second, this court can wait for the California Court of Appeal to rule on the summary judgment. And if the summary judgment is affirmed, this court can affirm because plaintiffs would have no trade secret ownership rights that could support any attempt to bring federal courts. And if the California Court of Appeals...
Mr. Graves, by the way, what is the status of that appeal? I assume the appeal has been taken, right? To the first district? Or fourth?
No, Your Honor.
Fifth district? Sixth district?
Not yet, Your Honor. Not yet, Your Honor.
You can't... You haven't even taken the appeal because it's only an interim ruling. When do you expect trial court proceedings in that case to conclude?
So the first summary judgment was issued last December on the trade secret claim. We've just won the second summary judgment this past Friday. We couldn't see the order because it's still under seal. But on Friday, we won the other part of the case. We do still have...
Does that constitute 100% of the case?
No, Your Honor. We, Google, still have cross claims. But all of the plaintiff's claims have been resolved against them in the trial court. So no appeal has yet been taken.
My question is, how long is it going to be till you get a final, appealable judgment?
Given the timelines that we're seeing in this district, I think it would be a long time. We're happy for the court to dispose of the case now by affirming Judge Freeman's rulings. Turning to the merits, the plaintiffs have alleged in paragraphs 88 that the trade secrets were extinguished, that's their word, through patent publication back in 2012. So all parties agree that no trade secrets existed after 2012. Now, a former trade secret that used to be valid, but lost that status before May of 2016, cannot be the object of a non-retroactive statute that governs quote-unquote trade secrets after May of 2016. But does not govern former trade secrets. The DTSA covers information that meets a four-part definition of a trade secret. It says that the owner of such a defined trade secret can bring a claim, but it does not purport to create liability for information that ceased to be a trade secret before the statute's May 2016 enactment date. Reading the statute retroactively would violate congressional intent. Now, to be sure.
Is this in effect, your argument as to why estoppel shouldn't apply?
Your Honor, a non-retroactive statute cannot be made retroactive by arguing that a defendant acted badly and therefore is disqualified from asserting retroactivity. Now, to be clear,
what's your best case that supports that proposition in a factual context like we have here?
The statement
you made was that something like what? A non-retroactive statute cannot be made retroactive, right? Is that what you said?
Yes, the syllogism that we're being offered, Judge, is that if there is bad behavior before a statute is enacted, the badly behaving party cannot point out that a later enacted statute is not retroactive. Let's be clear, Google has never argued that under trade secret law, a party that wrongfully discloses a trade secret would not be liable under the law that exists at the time. Here, that was California state law. If you disclose somebody's trade secret, you are liable for that act under the law in place at the time. But you are permitted to point out that a later enacted statute is not retroactive if someone tries to argue that your previous act, is covered by the later enacted statute. Now, to be clear, under the DTSA, one can misappropriate a still secret trade secret as of May 2016 if it was surreptitiously disclosed between or among bad actors before that date. Because in that circumstance, the information has not yet become generally known, which is how the statute defines trade secrecy. But by contrast, you cannot misappropriate a former trade secret under the statute that was extinguished by patent publication before that date. All of the courts who consider this question agree. That's Judge Freeman, that's the Avago case, that's the Hasbro case in the District of Rhode Island. And as the Federal Circuit put it under California law in the Ultimax case, quote, it's well established that the disclosure of a trade secret in a patent places the information into the public domain.
Well, counsel, what considerations did Google provide to the plaintiff or plaintiffs in exchange for the various agreements that he entered, in particular the assignments?
Judge Kerwin found in his summary judgment order last December, Google obtained ownership of his patents through assignments, and Section 3 of the ISA contract, Judge, grants consideration in the form of a specific patent license back to Mr. Attia and his family. But the contract spells out the consideration that was given. There's no dispute that Mr. Attia and his family were given the licenses they were promised by Google. So consideration was received, and as the court found in issuing summary judgment, Mr. Attia signed the assignments. He recited correctly that consideration had already been given, and he transferred all right, title, and interest to Google. So there is no trade secret case in the state court. And because there's a 100% overlap between the trade secret claims in the state case and the federal case, there could never be a federal claim here if the Court of Appeals in the state court affirms that summary judgment, Judge. So the contract spells out the consideration, and there is no dispute that that consideration is given.
Why is that consideration valuable? He owned the intellectual property. He's allowing Google to use it and develop it, and he gets a license, so which means he can use it, and he could have used it anyway. What benefit did he get? Why is that valid consideration?
It's a great question. So the project had him assign anything he created after the project started, plus the co-inventors, the other people on these patents, Judge, they contributed pieces as well. So what he got was a new set of software-related patents based on the work of multiple co-inventors of inventions that the USPTO has agreed were novel that did not exist before. So he got something new and different, and he agreed to that in a contract, and the state court has already found that that occurred on its summary judgment order.
Could I interrupt your thinking just to see what your position is. We've had a lot of help from the Northern District of California, which is not unsurprising. They get a lot of these kinds of cases. The same month that the district court in this case made its decision, it was a decision by Judge Edward Chen, whom we all respect as a fine judge. I'd like to have you tell me why Judge Chen is wrong on his analysis, if you believe that he is. Could you help me with that?
The distinction, Judge, is the line of cases that involve surreptitious or covert disclosures of a trade secret between wrongdoers before the date the statute is enacted, in which case you can bring a DTSA claim. And on the other hand, patent publication, which destroys the trade secret before the statute is enacted. If you still have a valid trade secret as of the day the statute is enacted, then of course you do have a claim. So if a group of wrongdoers disclose a trade secret among themselves, it's still a trade secret on the day that the DTSA is enacted, and a claim still exists. Now, the plaintiffs would like to claim that in both cases, in both surreptitious disclosure and patent publication, trade secrecy is extinguished. But the text of the statute rules out that argument in at least three different ways.
First, suppose we conclude that Judge Chen was correct in his analysis. What would that do to your case?
Nothing, because the surreptitious disclosure of a trade secret between wrongdoers maintains trade secrecy. You still have trade secret rights. So, of course, you can still bring that claim after May of 2016. Our case is different. It's a public disclosure that, by all agreement, eliminated trade secret rights back in 2012. That's not a covert disclosure that maintains a trade secret. We can see this difference in the structure of the statute in at least three different ways. In other words, there's a major distinction between something that is extinguished before May of 2016 and something that is still a trade secret on the day the DTSA is enacted, but was shared covertly by wrongdoers beforehand. Let me explain. First, information loses trade secret status when it becomes generally known, such as patent publication. But a covert disclosure between wrongdoers before the date of the statute does not cause the information to become generally known and lose trade secret status. Two, the DTSA includes liability for a situation where someone wrongfully acquires a trade secret and then discloses that quote-unquote trade secret to another person. In other words, according to the statute, a group of bad actors can disclose a trade secret among themselves covertly without the trade secret owner losing rights against the world. Third, the statute allows a court to issue an injunction to take steps to protect a quote-unquote trade secret. And so if your trade secret falls into the hands of a competitor through an improper disclosure, you still have trade secret rights, and you can get an injunction to get it back, which is a very common form of injunction in trade secret law. So we can tell from the text of the statute that Judge Freeman and Judge Chen and all of the other courts looking at these cases are all consistent and correct, for the simple reason that a covert or surreptitious disclosure between wrongdoers before the DTAS is enacted does not extinguish trade secret rights. You still get to bring that claim. However,
if you're before Judge Chen right now on this case, how would you show that his opinion is consistent with the points you're making now?
I would focus on the difference between extinguishment by patent publication and a disclosure among wrongdoers where it's still a trade secret. As I teach my law students in class, Judge, you can pass a trade secret in a group of wrongdoers. They can disclose it to one another, but the owner still has rights. So Judge Chen is correct and the other judges are correct. And when you have a surreptitious disclosure among wrongdoers, you still have trade secret rights, and therefore you can still bring a DTSA claim. By major contrast, if the trade secret is published to the world years before, there is no trade secret, and therefore the DTSA cannot attach because it only applies to things that are trade secrets on the day that the statute is enacted. So there's no big controversy here at all. All of the retroactivity cases are consistent with one another because there's either a public disclosure that eliminates trade secrecy, or you still have trade secret rights because the only disclosure was covert and surreptitious among a group of wrongdoers, and you still get a claim for that. So it's a very simple distinction, and all of the cases line up consistently with both Judge Chin, Judge Freeman, and all of the others who've been looking at these cases.
Judge Chin didn't think it was that easy in his decisions. Well, I'll wait for your adversary to see if he agrees with you. Thank you for that analysis.
All right, so Mr. Graves, we're down to just over a minute. Did you want to leave that time for your colleague?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. This is Robert Kent appearing on behalf of the Flux defendants. I'll try to be brief. I wanted to make just a few brief points that are specific to the Flux defendants with respect to the estoppel argument that counsel was pressing during his opening speech today. It's uncontested both in the it's uncontested in the briefs that that estoppel does not apply to Flux or the Flux individuals. That appeared in the Google brief. The plaintiffs did not challenge that position in their brief, and so we respectfully submit that they've waived estoppel as to Flux and Flux defendants, but as to the substance of the argument, plaintiffs actually do not cite any specific plausible facts that would suggest that the Flux defendants or Flux itself did any took any bad acts as part of the patent process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. That was very brief. Well done. All right, so we're back to Mr. Floyd. He's got just a little over 4 minutes. And Mr. Floyd, you still can't see the clock at this point?
No, I apologize. I'm afraid I can't, but I'm going to have a colleague sitting next to me let me know when I'm at 2 minutes. And
okay.
That'll work. So thank you, Judge Hayes.
I'll let you know when you get to the end as well. So please go ahead.
I knew that would happen. Yes, thank you. First of all, Google never relied on the assignment in moving to dismiss in federal court. None of the parties' arguments on the federal claims ever mentioned the contract or assignment. It's only at issue in the state court litigation. And you'll notice that when asked, my brother responded by citing the Superior Court record, not the record in the district court. It is correct that the Superior Court issued an adverse ruling. There is not a final judgment. The average time to disposition in the Sixth District Court of Appeals is, by our information, 856 days. This case is fully briefed. It is ready for decision, and it does present some novel questions that have not been decided by any other circuit courts. We suggest it's appropriate to proceed. None of the cases cited by Google address the issue of estoppel. None of them are estoppel cases. And so it's a bit of a straw man. They go through the cases and they like the Avago case, but it's important to realize Avago was one of the very first cases to address any of these issues. And when you go to the Alter G case, which is Judge Chin's case that Judge Wallace was referring to, it notes that Avago had basically said, well, we really don't have anything going the other way. But Avago was one of the first cases out of the gate. 2 years later, by the time Alter G was decided, it said courts have generally held that the continued use of a trade secret after the effective date of the DCA is actionable, even if the secret was initially disclosed prior to May 11, 2016. Precisely the opposite of what Google argued.
In Judge Chen's case, he points out that since that time, cases have consistently endorsed just the view that was that they were considering. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And in essence, what this court's going to have to deal with is a small bucket of district court cases. There is little circuit court guidance on this. But I should point out that you're not only dealing with the DTSA, and Google's response was almost exclusively to the DTSA. It does not address Section 1832, which is broader. And 1832 specifically prohibits possessions. And as we have pointed out, if, in fact, these trade secrets were wrongfully acquired, continued possession of them was a post-May 11, 2016 violation of the trade secrets statute. It was a RICO predicate act. It supports pattern, it supports relationship, and it supports conspiracy. And the RICO case should proceed. It is not the same as the DTSA case. It's not coextensive, and it provides somewhat different remedies. And it's important that these two things not simply be treated as being of a piece, because they are not.
Mr. Floyd, you referred just a couple minutes ago to Google's continued possession of the trade secrets right after the DTSA came into effect. But what about the point Google makes that the patent application with your client's consent and the publication of that, extinguished the trade secret. So there was no trade secret it could continue to profit from.
Yes, Judge Wallace, that certainly is their position, and our position is that they are stopped from relying on their own misconduct. I want to be very clear, we do not concede that we consented to that publication. The complaint says to the contrary, and we're going by the complaint here. And so as a consequence, given the procedural posture of this case, while they can deny it and they can controvert it, their denial is not dispositive. We look to the allegation, not the supposed refutation at this stage. Our point is that in raising estoppel, that distinguishes this case from the district court cases relied upon by our opponents, because none of them were estoppel cases, and none of them were Section 1832 cases. The only thing that they present is...
Mr. Floyd, have you or your client, through some other attorney, taken steps to challenge the patent?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor, but I am not counsel in the state court litigation. There is not a patent challenge in this case before you, and I can't make representation.
Well, why not? Essentially, I think your position seems to be that, it was obtained through fraudulent misrepresentations.
The trade secret information was, yes, Ron.
But still, Mr. Atiyah and his corporation haven't challenged the validity of the patent.
They have not done so in this proceeding, Your Honor.
Or any other proceeding?
To my knowledge, no. But again, Your Honor, I want to be quite careful. I am not counsel in the Superior Court proceeding, and I would not want to make a mistake in representation of this court either way.
Well, I would think a challenge to the patent would be a federal court proceeding.
It would normally be in the federal circuit, I believe.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. So we're a bit over time now. Unless Judge Wallace or Judge Tishima has any additional questions, we will submit this case.
I'm fine.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And the case is taken under submission.
Thank you.